the bare-bones shuttlecraft called Broomsticks. But now the whole region was quiet, empty. This war was costing Masterson Corporation millions of dollars per day, and even though the UN promised reparations, Myers knew that nothing could repay time lost, careers interrupted.
"There you are!"
Jill turned from the circular glass steel observation port to see Aidan McGrath standing in the hatch. His sizable bulk almost filled the hatchway, the lighting from the central corridor silhouetting him dramatically. "You finally got here," Myers said, taking a step toward him.
"I've been looking all over this tin can for you," he replied gruffly. "Come on, let's eat. I haven't had a bite since breakfast."
The hotel's restaurant was nearly empty, only two other couples sitting at the elegant tables, and a family of four off in the farthest corner where the children wouldn't annoy other diners. "They've got more waiters than customers," Myers noticed as she scanned the richly decorated room. Window wall screens displayed astronomical scenes, glorious interstellar nebulas glowing delicate pink and electric blue. Myers realized that real windows would have shown the scenery outside spinning lazily, not the most soothing background for flatland tourists to eat and drink by. McGrath had ordered champagne. They clinked their fluted glasses and toasted each other's health. Myers had dressed in comfortable tan slacks and a loose blouse embroidered with flowers. McGrath wore a bulky white turtleneck sweater over jeans that looked stiffly new. With a lopsided grin on his beefy face, McGrath asked,
"Do you come here often?"
It was a corny line, and they both knew it. Myers laughed politely. "I used to, in the old days."
"I understand you were quite a hellraiser back then," he said.
Her smile turned reminiscent. "Back then," she murmured. The waiter brought them oversized menus. McGrath ordered three courses and more wine, Myers only a salad.
"Okay," he said after the waiter had left. "You asked me to meet you here. What's up?"
Myers looked into his pale blue eyes.
"Aidan, you know that if I were still in the Senate, I'd be raising all kinds of hell about this war against Moonbase."
"I'd hardly call it a war," he said.
"That's what your network calls it."
McGrath shrugged.
"That's show business, Jill. You know how it is."
"I need your help to put pressure on the president," she said.
His brows rose slightly.
"I thought you were on her side. You're the same party."
"Not on this," Myers snapped. "I've never been a blind supporter of the new morality, and she knows it. She named me to the World Court to get me out of the Senate because she knew I'd raise hell about going after Moonbase."
"Why don't you raise hell now? I'd give you all the airtime you want."
"I can't," Myers said, shaking her head. "As a judge in the International Court of Justice, I've got to stay strictly out of politics."
With a laugh, McGrath asked, "What you're doing now isn't politics?"
"This is private, just between you and me."
"And global news in the White House," he added.
Myers gave him a disdainful look.
"You know what I mean, Aidan."
"Okay, okay," he said, raising his hands in mock surrender. "But what more can I do? Global's been airing E.D. Elgin's reports from Moonbase. Foray's pissed as hell with me over that."
"You could start by showing what a ghost town this space station has become," Myers said. "American jobs are down the tubes because of Foray."
"And the new morality's insistence that the nanotech treaty be enforced even on the moon."
"Right."
"You want me to take on the new morality?"
She hesitated, studying the expression on his face. McGrath had been handsome before he'd let himself start going to fat. He still looked pretty good. But is he strong enough? Myers wondered.
Carefully, she said, "I want you to show the American public, the world public, really, how much this war against Moonbase is really costing."
The waiter brought McGrath's first course. Once he left, McGrath lifted his soup spoon, but instead of digging in, he jabbed it in Myers' direction.
"You know," he said, "there's nothing like a really good controversy to boost ratings."
Myers grinned at him. Moonbase.
"What on earth are you doing?"
Claire Rossi blurted. Nick O'Malley was dragging a bulky container into their one-room quarters. It looked like an oversized piece of soft-sided luggage
and it made their little compartment crowded.
"Emergency procedure," O'Malley said, pushing the container into the corner between the bunk and the desk. Still, it took up almost half the floor space.
Rossi watched impatiently as her husband knelt on one knee and began to rip open the Velcro seams of the container. She leaned over his broad shoulder and looked inside.
"A spacesuit?"
"Right," O'Malley said. "I'm going to show you how to get into it in case you need to while I'm not here."
"Why would I—" "Oh."
As he hauled the torso and leggings of the suit out and spread them on the bunk, O'Malley said, "When the attack comes, we might lose air pressure. This gadget here will yowl when the pressure drops below a safe minimum." He put a small gray box on the shelf carved into the stone wall above the bunk.
"When you hear this go off, you get into the suit as fast as you can. Here, I'll show you how."
"But suppose I'm in the personnel office when it happens?" she asked. O'Malley shook his head. "When the peacekeepers start their attack, everybody not on essential duty will go to their quarters. That's orders from management."
She almost started to twit him about her personnel job being considered non-essential, but the dead serious expression on her husband's face stopped her. Instead, she asked, "Is everybody getting a spacesuit?"
"Not enough to go around," he answered, shaking his head.
"Then why do I get special treatment?"
He smiled bleakly at her.
"Because you're a special person. You're married to me, and you're pregnant."
"But that means somebody else will have to go without a suit." His lips were a grim, pinched line.
"Claire, hundreds of people here are going to go without a suit, but you're not. Now let me show you how to put it on properly."
She knew better than to argue with him.
"He's trying to protect me," she told herself, "and the baby. But if the air pressure goes down, lots of people will die here. And how long will the suit keep me?"
Aloud, as she struggled into the clumsy leggings, she asked,
"Where will you be when the shooting starts? Not operating the tractors, of course."
He scowled.
"No, I've been assigned to help Professor Zimmerman for the sake of St. Ignatius."
"Zimmerman?"
"I think Doug Stavanger wants me to be the old man's bodyguard."
"Is the professor getting a suit?" Rossi asked as she tugged on the boots.
"There isn't one in the base that'd fit him."
"Oh, dear."
As he knelt at her feet and helped her zip the boots and leggings together, O'Malley said, "After just half a day with the old bugger, I almost wish somebody would knock him off."
"That's no way to talk, Nick. He's impossible. He's a genius, and geniuses have their quirks."
O'Malley made a sour face.
"You know what I've been doing for him all morning? Collecting dust."
"What?"
"I've been teleoperating a tractor all damn morning, scooping up dust off the regolith for him to experiment with."
"That sounds crazy."
"Tell me about it. He wants to build nanomachines that behave like dust particles, so he tells me he needs samples of dust to work with."
Rossi wormed her arms into the suit's torso, then popped her head through the neck ring.
"Why does he want to make nanomachines that behave like dust particles?" she asked.
"Because he's way beyond quirky, that's why. He's outright daft."
Savannah.
"It's easy duty," said the security chief. "Four men outside, two inside. Pretty soft, really."
Jack Killifer sat in the stiff little plastic chair in front of the chief's metal desk, trying hard to keep his face from showing what he was feeling inside.
"I'm in Joanna Brudnoy's house," he exulted. "Okay, it's just the servants' wing of the house, but still, here I am."
The security chief wore a tan summer weight uniform with epaulettes and shoulder patches, and even a couple of medals pinned above his left breast pocket. Tin soldiers, Killifer thought. He himself was in a baggy shirt and Levi's, the uniform of the day as instructed. The security chief kept glancing at the array of display screens that made up one whole wall of the bare little office. They showed security camera views of the grounds around the house, the garage, the pool area, and every room inside except the master bedroom.
"The only thing you've got to remember," the chief said, swiveling his attention back and forth between the screens and Killifer, "is that she doesn't like to see uniformed guards around the place."
"So we dress like gardeners," Killifer said, putting just a hint of disdain in it.
"Yeah, both chauffeurs are on the team, of course,
and the butler's supposed to be a black belt.